The book begins in a homeless shelter. How has writing this book, in a sense, rehomed you?
Boy, I think it centered me back into myself. It helped me have compassion for myself and that period of my life. In writing it, I saw just how difficult that circumstance was. And at the time that it was happening, I only felt like a failure. And now that I've kind of been through, I guess, the other side, or I'm in a more privileged position, I'm able to see just how difficult that was and see that I truly was surviving.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Stephanie Land about her memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stay with us. And Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote Nickel and Dimed, writes in the foreword, "If this book inspires you, which it may, remember how close it came to never being written." How did you trust that you had a story to tell?
Well, I think being a writer, that is kind of your purpose, is to share your story with people. As writers, we kind of share a story so that we don't feel alone. And so there was that aspect to it. But I really didn't think this part of my life was very interesting until the original article went viral. And suddenly I saw, like, oh, okay, well, maybe people do want to hear about this.
And the book shares experiences about being degraded and condescended and judged for your circumstance. And I want you to read a paragraph and then I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah, sure. "When people think of food stamps, they don't envision someone like me. Someone plain-faced and white. Someone like the girl they'd known in high school who'd been quiet but nice. Someone like a neighbor. Someone like them. Maybe that made them too nervous about their own situation. Maybe they saw, in me, the chance of their own fragile circumstances, that, with one lost job, one divorce, they'd be in the same place as I was."
There were heartbreaking moments when these encounters happened, like with medical staff and even assistance program staff, and as well as bystanders and checkout lines. What do you wish people understood about what it means to be in poverty?
Well, I think the common misconception is that we're not working and that we're choosing to not work and just kind of like sit back and like rake in all this government money that they think we're getting and doing that purposefully and not trying to improve our lives, when really it's the opposite. Most people on government assistance are working to some extent, and they have families and they have children, and they need this assistance because their wages aren't nearly the amount that they should be. So it's a means of survival. It's not necessarily a means of taking advantage or being lazy. And so I wish that we would just kind of drop this notion of, you know, requiring proof of work, when I think most people find a lot of pride and satisfaction in work and making ends meet and providing for their family. But it just seems like there's this judgment or stigma that people on government assistance don't have that drive.
You also write, "I'd wonder if the person's view of me would change if they knew I was on food stamps. Would they assume I had less potential?" So this sense of potentiality really struck me. What is the unseen potential of people in poverty?
I hear a lot. I've even heard it on book tour. People have asked me, like, it just seems like people in poverty just don't even try, or they don't know how to handle their finances. They don't know how to save or anything like that. And I'm kind of struck by how common that misconception is. I was not encouraged to get an education. I lost benefits because I was in school full time and wasn't able to work 20 hours a week. And so I was dropped from the food benefits program. And also, life was so bleak for so long, I didn't want to imagine 5 years from then, because I didn't want to imagine that I would still be living the life that I was. So every single time that I got like an extra $10 or something, I didn't think, oh, I need to save this. It was, I need to provide my daughter with a momentary joy that she could have, because I felt like I could rarely give that to her. And just even getting her a Happy Meal was a special treat. As a parent, you want to be able to give that to your kid. And when I hear these things like, well, they just don't know how to save money, it's not that we don't know how, it's what are we saving for?
Right. But there was something about this book where you always had a dream about writing. So how did you keep that part of the dream alive?
I think being a writer for me was kind of like this nagging voice that constantly reminded me, but you're a writer. Being in the position that I was, being a writer meant being an artist and kind of like being this elite member of society that isn't really affordable or accessible to a lot of people in the lower classes. So I put it off as long as possible. And it was a huge risk to finally embrace it entirely and get a degree in English, which at the time I was just like, well, what in the world am I going to do with a degree in English? But I mean, it was also a drive, not only just to do that for myself, but to do that for my kid. I wanted her to know that whatever she wanted to be, she could, and no matter what situation. I wasn't totally sure that I would be able to prove that to her, but I wanted to try as much as possible.
As a house cleaner, you wrote about becoming a witness, and I was hoping that you would read a little section on that too.
Sure. I became a witness. Even odder was my invisibility and anonymity, though I spent several hours a month in their homes. My job was to wipe away dust, dirt, and make lines and carpets, to remain invisible. I almost felt like I had the opportunity to get to know my clients better than any of their relatives did. I'd learn what they ate for breakfast, what shows they watched, if they'd been sick, and for how long. I'd see them, even if they weren't home, by the imprints left in their beds and tissues on the nightstand. I'd know them in a way few people did, or maybe ever would.
I'm thinking about the invisibility of the work that you did and the fact that you did it for minimum wage and the toll it took on your body. What would you want people who hire house cleaners to know, you know, from the other side?
I had a guy interview me, and we went through this whole interview for a radio station or podcast or something. And he called me back a couple of days later. And he said, I just had a quick question for you. And I said, okay. And he said, I have to tell you, I have house cleaners. And it snowed a lot today. And they got stuck at the bottom of my driveway and then had to leave. And they were really worried about getting in trouble with their boss. And, you know, I called their boss and said it was okay. It wasn't any fault of theirs. But now I'm sitting here thinking, and after reading your book and talking to you, I just realized they're not going to get paid for those hours. So what can I do? And I was like, man, this is awesome that you're asking me this. And I said, you could offer to pay for it, even though they didn't clean that day. You know, make sure their boss knows that it was not any fault of theirs, that you're not upset. See if you can reschedule the clean. Because, yeah, those are wages that they're going to miss out on. I think a lot of people didn't really see that. Because to them, it was a disposable service that, oh, well, I'm homesick today. You don't need to come clean. When to me, that was $40 that was going to pay my electric bill that I wouldn't be able to make up or get back. It's a scary position to be in when you're truly dependent on other people's whims, that you have to constantly cater to those whims. And they don't even recognize that you're a human being most of the time, or that you have a life, or just how important that job is.
I love this sense of humanity, and it got me thinking about this part of the book that I knew I was bracing myself for, which is a part about snooping. And I really just want to have you read that tiny little section.
Oh, okay. For some houses, that meant I had time to stop and thumb through books sitting on nightstands or kitchen counters. I began looking through the rapidly growing stashes of alcohol, hidden chocolate, unopened bags from the mall that remained untouched for months. I became intrigued by understanding how people coped. I snooped because I was bored, and in a way, it became my own coping mechanism. I started to love the houses that didn't echo in vacancy. I appreciated my Friday mornings with Henry. I never snooped in houses where I wasn't invisible, where my name was Stephanie instead of cleaning service or even maid on their calendar. And I never looked through the stuff of clients I made on my own outside of Classic Clean. We had a mutual respect for each other, and over time, some became friends. The snooping was like uncovering clues, finding evidence of the secret lives of people who seemed like they had it all. Despite being wealthy and having the two-story houses of our American dreams, the marbled sink bathrooms, the offices with bay windows looking out at the water, their lives still lacked something. I became fascinated by the things hidden in dark corners and the self-help books for hope. Maybe they just had longer hallways and bigger closets to hide the things that scared them.
So the article that was published in Vox was called "I Spent 2 Years Cleaning Houses. What I Saw Makes Me Never Want to Be Rich." And I just want you to comment on the human condition. You know, that's what that paragraph to me signals, is that we're all trying to cope with something. What's your sense?
My sense was kind of one of disenchantment. I remember being surprised that my clients, who were, you know, much wealthier than me, upper middle class or whatever, I was surprised that they were affected by the common cold. Because I assumed that once you're in that position, you have access to yoga and doctors and medicine and kale and smoothies and like all of these things that are supposed to keep you healthy. And so it was really eye-opening for me that they had these common ailments and that they were still human beings, when I assumed the upper classes were kind of superhuman because they had somehow made it through all of these circumstances that I was still fighting against.
And had won like the immunity coin or something.
Yeah, something like that. Or they had just made it and gone over to the other side where everything was perfect and happy and wonderful all the time.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Stephanie Land about MADE: hard work, low pay, and a mother's will to survive. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. I was trying to identify the themes in this book, and obviously one is the trudge of just trying to crawl out of the place where the book begins, in a homeless shelter. But to me, the book also was just about vulnerability over and over and over again. You know, vulnerable after a car wreck, vulnerable at the doctor's office. And now, I mean, I hear you commenting on the vulnerability of being wealthy too. I mean, in a sense, right? That no one's ever really... So I want to know now, like, now that the book is written, it's a New York Times bestseller, what's your relationship to vulnerability?
Oh, I still feel that way. I feel that way every morning when I wake up and I know that I have an event that night. I am still introverted, and I feel the physical effects of that along with the mental. And so it is a very vulnerable place for me to stand in front of an audience, especially after several years of being a writer on the internet. I have received death threats. You know, I have received endless days of troll comments, and I am always sure that one of them is going to show up to an event. And shout some like horrible thing at me. It never happens. And I actually walk away from events feeling connected with readers and feeling supported and loved in like a really genuine way. And that has been amazing. But there is still like this part of my body that's reacting in almost like a PTSD type of way. Just facing your audience literally face to face is still kind of scary when you've been through this horrible internet situation for so many years.
Right, right. Can you give listeners just a brief sketch of what you went through with the internet trolls?
Well, I mean, when the original article was published on Vox, I received hate messages for at least a month. And it was the first time that I had ever really published anything on like a big national platform. It was extremely overwhelming and surprising. I've had someone describe it as being caught in a tornado and a tidal wave at the same time. And all of these people are kind of screaming at you. I received countless messages calling me a cockroach and a vermin, that I should be in jail, my kids should be taken away from me. And then there's all of the pleasant cuss words and all of that stuff. Most are grammatically incorrect, which I try to enjoy. But I remember going outside and like a week after the Vox article was published and just going for a walk along the river with a friend of mine, feeling branches kind of hitting me and having this sense to duck down. I remember feeling that I felt so similarly to that just in my own home, that I was just kind of ducking and trying to avoid all of these comments coming at me constantly. I mean, at the time I didn't have a smartphone, so it was just coming through my computer. But another time that I went viral, and I did have a smartphone then, it was like every single time I looked at my phone, I had 20 plus notifications from Twitter and Facebook, emails and everything. And it was all full of hate, and it gets to you. I would say my humanity, or my sense of humanity and my outlook on people really changed for quite a long time.
Where do you stand with that today?
I think it's getting better. It's easy to feel isolated, especially in Missoula, Montana, and especially when you work from home and you have two kids and you don't get out much. So I think the more people that I'm meeting and the more that I'm seeing the good in people, it's really good for me. Because before, it just seemed like I experienced the worst parts of people more than I experienced the good parts.
I want to talk about connection. I happen to be reading your book alongside Michael Ondaatje's book Warlight. And in the book, he actually writes, "When you attempt a memoir, I am told, you need to be in an orphan state. So what is missing in you and the things you've grown cautious and hesitant about will come almost casually towards you. A memoir is the lost inheritance." What do you think your lost inheritance is?
I think it's being estranged from family and feeling so incredibly alone. I think that was my biggest downfall in my story, because I somewhat desperately searched for connection with people, sometimes I think detrimentally to my responsibilities as a parent. But it's a really hard thing to face, not only that you only have yourself to fall back on, but that it might be that way for a very long time. And there is a certain type of aloneness in that I think is not something that many people experience. And it really hardens you. So it was hard for me to write about that without letting the desperation come out on the page, even though it was a very desperate place.
You write about feeling emotionally orphaned by your parents, but the line that really broke my heart came in the middle of the book. "Sometimes mothers need to be mothered too." What can you, I mean, you've sort of spoken to this, but I'm just thinking about the connection between mothering and your struggle, you know, like what would have mothering looked like for you had you received it?
Oh, I just having a mom to call and having someone available on the other end of the line that had advice on what to do with a fever or advice on what to do with a picky eater or anything like that, or just reassurance that I was doing a good job. It's like I just needed one person to tell me that I was a good mom. You want that to come from your own mom. And I never got that. It was really hard. I have friends who are very close to their mothers. Their moms genuinely love their kids and them. They're always sending packages and cards and their grandma. I wanted that for my daughter so much, but at the same time, I really needed my mom.
Can we talk about Mia a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I love talking about Mia.
I've seen some recent publicity photos, and you guys are in these shots together. And I just want to know, like, what was it like for you to write your relationship with Mia? And what does she say about the process? And now you're on book tour. And
she's pretty proud of me. She enjoys it. She likes it that her principal and the secretary, and she just asked to give a signed copy to her teacher this morning. And she's reading the book right now. And she has like really weird questions. Like, are you sure that his eyes weren't green? Or, you know, little detail fact check things. But she hasn't responded much to the fact that the book is mostly about my relationship with her. So we haven't really gotten any deep discussions over it, but she's enjoying the fame, I think. But she's always been like that. She's always wanted to be center stage. And anytime her picture was in the local magazine or a, you know, nationally public type of publication, she got pretty excited. She would want to know like how many likes my post got or weird kid stuff that is foreign to me because yeah. It's taken a lot for me to publish the things that I have over the years. But she's so excited to be talked about in all of these circles all over.
In terms of the craft of writing memoir, I was also wondering how you approach the writing of sort of the villainous characters, the abusive exes, the disrespectful landlords.
I went into it not wanting to assume anything that they were thinking or what their motivations were. I tried to keep it as much my story as possible. But as far as like the situation with Mia's dad or abusive whatever, I didn't want to give them any space on the page. I didn't want to give them, I don't know, I didn't want to give them any part of my book other than my reactions to what was going on. But I also wrote this in mind that my daughter was going to read it someday, and I didn't want to do any more damage than had already been done. So I kept that very much in mind. I think a lot of the characters I honestly was pretty easy on. I could have talked about things that happened that were much worse, but I didn't really see the good in that. I felt like it was indulging the reader a little bit too much in things that I didn't really see important in progressing the narrative. And I kind of felt like we're similar to gossip, I guess.
I was looking online this morning, Stephanie, and was like, oh my gosh, this book hit the New York Times bestseller list. And then I immediately had this thought, oh no, this book runs the risk of perpetuating the rags to riches American dream narrative. If you just keep at it, you'll become a New York Times bestseller. And so I want to know, like, what has it been like for you to ride this process? And do you find any, like, what's your story? What's this story going to be in the long run about getting out of poverty and reaching a certain level of fame?
Boy, I try to talk about how privileged my story is, how privileged my book is, how white my book is. I realize that so much. I just hope that I'm grabbing people's attention and they'll start listening to the millions of other stories behind it. But also, I'm not a success story as far as the government assistance programs are involved, or I don't consider myself a success story, because that would mean that government assistance programs are successful. I got a book deal, and I had this wild success with my career as a writer, and it's not something that I can say a handful of people I know personally have happened to. It's a really crazy thing that happened to me. I would hope that people would recognize that not everybody in poverty follows the same path that I'm on. I don't know. I think we want so much for this myth that we've been raised on of, if you work hard in this country, then you'll make it and you'll be successful. And so I think the people who are kind of driving that myth down our throats like to point to people like me and say, see, if you work hard enough, you'll make it, when it's just really not true. There's absolutely no way that you can work hard enough when you're making $7 or $8 an hour and you have a family. I would hope that would be kind of common sense in looking at my path that I've been on for the last few years. People would see like how unique that is. But also, I would just hope that they realize that there are millions of others who are still struggling in way worse situations than I was, who may always struggle. I hope if I evoke some amount of empathy in them, then it will make the people who are still struggling, it will make their lives a little bit easier in the long run, because people might start voting differently. And that is the thing that I hope for the most to come out of this book.
We're doing this interview in Missoula, Montana, which in the book sort of acts like the promised land. Now that you've been here for a while, what's your reflection about that dream?
But I think I had a good hunch. Yeah. It worked out. It continues to work out. As much as I don't like absolutely no direct flights out of this town, it takes a whole entire day to fly somewhere, Missoula is still worth it. I love the surroundings. I love the people. I love how in love people are with Missoula. And that's a special thing. I can see my daughter still making connections with people. And I feel like we found our people here. As much as I have days where I don't like it here, there are a lot more where I truly do.
Stephanie Land is a New York Times best-selling author and former house cleaner. She lives with her two daughters in Missoula, Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.